Will came into the picture, and she chose this. This is what she chose, and now she's living with the consequences of that choice.
Let's see just how specifically, in fact, Dante uses Augustine's story at the end of the eighth book of the Confessions. First of all, Augustine's besetting sin, the thing that held him back from his conversion, as Ron described it, was lust. And the text that he reads when he opens Paul's letter to the Romans in chapter 13 starts out not in wantonness and lust and a few other things, but arm yourselves with the Lord Jesus you have no need for nature or nature's appetites. In other words, his was a turning away from lust, from the pleasures of the body, and towards self. That's certainly one thing. Secondly, it is indeed what's next to Augustine at his conversion is Paul, that is to say, St. Paul, his letter to the Romans. Francesca's partner is named Paolo, which is simply the Italian for Paul. If you will, she's got the wrong Paul.
Yeah, she's picked up the wrong Paul, yeah. If you can use that.
Yes, he really has. Yeah. Absolutely, and I think that's an important thing to see, too. The third thing is something we emphasized when we talked about Augustine in a previous lecture, and that is that one could make a worse argument than that Augustine's Confessions is about learning how to read, starting with his reading of the Aeneid, his bad reading of the Bible as an adolescent, all the way up to the time where he does indeed not only read Paul correctly, but he's also able to take it into himself, to internalize it, to make it a part of who he is, to make it a guide, and indeed to be the moment, that moment of reading is the moment of the turning of the will. And of course, all of these elements in Augustine are parodied here in Inferno 5.
And of course, what Francesca is essentially saying is she read in such a way that she couldn't possibly internalize the message, that there was something there, but what was there was per diletto, for kicks, to pass the time, to read in a kind of superficial way. Now, notice that Dante here, as a poet, is saying something also about possibly saying something about the limitations of his earlier poetry. Was that a kind of poetry that forced people to read per diletto, to not look as seriously as they should? That's at least a possibility to consider. But more important, of course, is that the lesson here links together the moment of the will, okay, that defines the sinner, the fact that she has so many other people to blame, the fact that she's utterly without self-knowledge in what she's done, and of course also the fact that Dante the Pilgrim buys it. His response to this, when he looks at it all, is not to say, "Ha, Francesca, what a crock." In fact, what he does is swoon. In fact, what he does is, well, faint, really. It's a way of saying, look, this is affecting him very deeply.
This is really the stuff of opera, is it not? I mean, just sort of try to, you can imagine how this has indeed been a topic for operas. I mean, here's this sort of romantic tale that she tells, and you can sort of picture, you know, what kind of character is going to sing her role, and then Dante sort of swoons and faints at the end. I mean, this really is the stuff of operas, and as I said, there certainly is one indeed based on this story. And it's very easy, perhaps more in our age than others, I don't know, but it's very easy for people to identify with Francesca. She was sort of either, you know, doing what comes naturally, or she was simply following her feelings. I think a lot of times people approach it that way and identify with Francesca, but of course that's what Dante does. He identifies with the sin and the sinner rather than with God's just punishment of the sinner. Dante's already learned as he went through the gate of hell in Canto 3 that hell is a place of justice. And I think we can say in one sense, if you swoon, if you feel sympathy, if you weep, if you feel pity in hell, you are in a sense sympathizing with the sinner. And to that extent, you are at least raising the question of the justice of this place, which is ultimately, therefore, to question the justice of God himself.
And notice also that with this first extended example of an interchange between Dante and an inhabitant of the afterlife, what you have is a sin that on the surface looks pretty good. Okay? Looks good, feels good, why not do it? But of course what we see is the sort of studied consequences of all of this. And I think it's important to realize that Dante the poet is giving to the reader clues that Dante the pilgrim at this point is unable to see or appreciate. That it's only later on in the narrative that Dante begins to pay attention to the same sort of clues that the reader must pay attention to see the way in which the narrative is going.
So that's sort of our exploration of Inferno 5, the first place again where we see real punishment and the first in this area of incontinence. I might add as a footnote that in each of the introductory cantos to a new area of sin, that is say the first canto that deals with incontinence, the first with violence, and the first with fraud, one of the interesting devices that Dante has to signal us that we're entering a new area is to give us a kind of mythological beast at the beginning that in some way exemplifies that sin. For example, in Inferno 5, at the beginning of incontinence, we have the figure of Minos. And Minos is this wonderful character that literally, in Inferno 5, judges with his tail. Interesting image for the sins of incontinence.